Thank you.
Okay, thanks to you. So, quite happy to be here and to speak right now. So, the thing I want to speak about is to report on some work that we recently did with Dmitry Wojciech and Wenwei, which is here. So it's about driven systems or many-body systems that are, so they are not closed in the sense that there is some SIM coming from outside. And the type of localization that I, so it's still, I mean, interested in localization in those systems, but not in the sense, well, it's many-body localization in the sense that they're many-body system, but it's not what is called MBL in the sense that I'm not interested in things where there are LIOMs and it's not a spatial structure. So I'm rather interested in things that break ergodicity or forever or for a long time because there is emergence of effective conserved quantity that appear in the system. So just to illustrate, perhaps if let's start with a one body problem. So this is the ping pong problem. So what is ping pong? So an idealized ping pong, right? So you would have here a paddle which is played by a machine and something like that, right? And there is a ball, and this ball, what it does is just like bouncing back and forth between the wall here and the paddle which is here. And there would be, I would distinguish two regimes. So this paddle is oscillating, and if it oscillates randomly, then what's going to happen is that the motion of the motion of the ball will also be random, and the velocity, the kinetic energy will increase linearly in that system, right? So that's what I would refer to thermal phenomenon. Another possibility is that this oscillates in a periodic way, and if it goes smoothly, then that has system that has been studied a lot, and then what they have found is that there is no escape, as they say, which means that the velocity of this particle remains bounded. And so this is the case where there is the emergence of a conserved quantity in the sense that, so energy was not conserved initially, but since there is a phenomenon who makes that the kinetic energy of this particle cannot just increase forever, right? So the thing that I would like to discuss here is can we make many-body version, quantum many-body version of this sort of simple example? Perhaps an example that you know even better is the Kick's water problem, right? So this is the same sort of idea that is going there. So let's say one could be also interested in the case where the driving is not periodic but quasi-periodic. I think it is interesting, but there are not many work on it, so we'll not speak about it. And would also be interested in the case where perhaps there would eventually be an escape over infinite time, but for a very long time there would be something bounded that can be, I think, equally interesting because, in practice anyway, we don't observe systems just forever, right? So the plan of my talk would be to introduce a bit the many-body case, and then I will discuss the special case where the Hamiltonian that we look at is also MBL, in fact, so because then something a bit special happens. And then I will consider more generic systems and a couple of generalizations. So the paper that was we found very at least influential was a paper by Luca D'Alessio and I think it's Paul Kovnikov. And eventually we, at least in this original paper, we don't agree with the conclusions, but the way they introduced the topic we found very illuminating. So what we will consider is a Hamiltonian H that depends on T, and so let's say there is a time independent part H0, and then there is something V that depends on time. Let's say I will take periodic, so there is a period T and we have this, and what you can think as a typical example of that where it would be that V of T is just some function of time times a fixed operator. And to give even more precise, what phi can be just a square signal. So you would have t here, t over 2, let's say 0, and then 1, and then 0, 1, and so on. And that is the case where you just switch between two Hamiltonians. And that is a particular case, but it has still it is sort of easy to visualize this particular case. So the Hamiltonian V and H0 I take just as sum of local terms in some volume. So let's say H0 is like that, right? H. And the same for V. Okay. So this is sort of the model. So they give a precise meaning of what that means, what that would mean to say, what would that mean to have an effective conserved quantity, or what would that mean to heat up to infinite temperature. So what you can analyze is the over what happens over one cycle, right? So if you take the unitary, there is still a unitary evolution. So I consider systems that are open in the sense that there is a driving, but there's still systems that are described by unitary evolution. So let's say U over one period. So the Floques theory tells you that U, a guarantee that you can write that as E, an effective Hamiltonian time period T. Right? So this is quite a general fact that for finite volume, you will be able to produce this effective Hamiltonian. And there are two possibilities. The first possibility is that H effective would be, again, a sum of local term. So HF, you would be able to write it as sum over I. Well, there will not be, strictly speaking, local, but let's say quasi-local. In that sense, that would mean that that would be something that would survive in the thermodynamic limit and would describe a conserved quantity, an effective conserved quantity of this problem. And so let me stress that I'm not saying that this is a localized Hamiltonian, right? So there would be an effective conserved quantity, but this could a priori still be an ergodic Hamiltonian, in fact. Or at least at that time, they said that that was a possibility. And so the other possibilities, obvious, it is that you cannot do that, right? So that means that if volume increase, you will have fully non-local terms. And in that case, that is the case where you would just flow towards infinite temperature. There is just no structure left. Right? OK? Yes?
Question. So as you know, this is the H effective is not unique. So should we say that there exists no H effective with this local decomposition? Is that the statement?
Right. Yes. You're right to say that. Yes. So the eigenvalues are described up to models of 2 pi, right? So this is not unique in that sense. Now the eigen states are still unique, in fact. So I never thought whether there could be one that would be described like that, another one that could not be described like that. But so if one wants to be cautious. But the fact that the eigen states are all the same make me think that they will all be of that kind or all be of that kind. But I did not really think very far through this specific thing. But you are right. So to be cautious, let's say that there would at least be one. Yes. All right. So. The first thing you can say is it's nice because there is a formula. If you take this particular case, there is just a formula to express what will be the effective Hamiltonian, and this is known as this Baker-Hausdorff-Campbell formula. So the, let's say, BHC, which is also sometimes known as the Magnus expansion. Mm-hmm. So this what it is. So you, because the unitary will be E minus I, so for half of the period it's H0, and for the other half of the period it's H0 plus dV, and then the formula tells you how to perturbatively compute that. So what is, let me not write it fully because it's extremely painful, but essentially it is first just the sum as when they commute. And then appears commutator, so the next will be T square over, I think it's A here, and then it will come a J, commutator of H0 with V, and then appears further commutator, right? So the hope was the following, that if the period T, so T is the period, right? So if T is very small, so let me say I assume that I fix an energy scale which is of order 1 so that I don't have to write it again. So this just means that very, very small period compared to typical energy scale. So then they could say, well, that seems to go nice, right? Because you have t and then t squared, t to the third, and so on. So it looks like something convergent could appear. However, that is not correct, right? So the first expectation was if the period is very short, maybe there is sort of an overall averaging, and due to this averaging, there will be the effective quantity will appear. But if the period is larger, the system will have the time to absorb the energy from external driving, and you will heat up. So it's a bit strange if that would be true, because one is, in general speaking, about a system which would be ergodic, and one expects from an ergodic system that it can absorb just any frequency, even if that frequency is very large. So in particular, it's questionable whether that would be true. And if you look a bit more carefully at this Magnus expansion, you see that it's indeed only an asymptotic expansion. So, or at least, well, you could still say that one has not been clever enough to see why it converged, but quite generally, Magnus expansion is like taking a logarithm. So taking a logarithm is sort of not so easy operation. So if some things start being large, and how to see that in many body contexts, the Magnus expansion is not likely to. So why is that asymptotic? So if you go to term of order n, so the tn power in this expansion, you pick up an n order commutator. So you will have something like, I don't know, h0, and then you will have a v, and then again h0, blah, 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 blah. And this is what makes the difference between, let's say, single body dynamics and the many body dynamics, that those factors will behave like n factorial, and they cannot be killed. So there is another factorial coming from the downstairs thing, but it has to be eaten up by the number of terms that appear here. But you still, compared to single body, in the many body, you get this extra factorial. Yes?
Naively, you think that if you took the infinite frequency limit in a way that was before the thermodynamic limit, then mm-hmm. it should be okay.
That should be okay, yes, because then what would you do? You would have a finite system, and it should be okay. I guess it should be okay, let's say, at least if you then take this frequency really, really very high, then indeed, probably this expansion is going to converge, because those let's say, this by the finite volume, this will be limited somehow by the volume, right? So you will have, it probably going to be okay. Yes, you're right, yeah. So what does that mean? If you accept this, so you will have something like Tn to the power times n factorial. So essentially means that the series has to stop if you take n like 1 over t. And if you take plug n equal 1 over t in this formula, you see that this is going to give e minus 1 over t. So, okay, this now is very hand waving, but we made that a bit more precise. But somehow, what it means is that up to so long times, you can have an effective Hamiltonian, and once you go to times that start getting larger than that, then probably heating up will start appearing. However, what we found that was Magnus expansion was probably not the best way, let's say, to think about this problem, because it doesn't seem very flexible to us in particular. Why that is physical that you stop there, we really didn't see how to explore the results out of, so we decided to start a bit differently. So we looked, instead of trying directly to write an expansion, we decided to look at the problem in rotating frame. So what that means is that, so the unitary evolution can be decomposed that way. So
François, yes. I missed what you said about the denominator of the expansion. There's also a factorial in the denominator. Does that not matter?
It does matter.
The comparison you put in here is.
So you will have an n factor, I don't know by heart how that behaves, this factor, but it's somehow, yes, it's like 1 over n factorial downstairs.
Right.
But then you have a sum over all the way that you can combine those things.
So it's like factorial squared.
This provides a gain.
Yeah.
And if it was single body dynamics, it will be all because you will just have t to the n here, and that would be OK. But if it's many body, you get again this one. And this makes it that you won't continue, right? OK, so unitary. So let's try to look in terms of rotating frame instead of directly just making an expansion. So what is known from Fourier theory is that you can decompose it, the unitary, as the effective Hamiltonian, where this P is periodic. And this P, so this unit, this is also unitary and is periodic, and this P is the rotating frame transformation. So we would like just to see the problem in a frame which is rotated with time, and see the effective conserved quantity emerging there. So you can look what is the relation that is to be satisfied by P, and this is a computation that it should be this one. So with the h of t minus e I dvt p of t equals h effective. So this is going to be somehow the fundamental relation that one starts with. And we liked this because we started being familiar with Imbrie work in the context of many-body localization. And this is a close analogous. So what he would like to say is you have a matrix. You need to find a unitary transformation so that this is diagonal. And what we say is there is this time-dependent object. And we'd like to find a transformation which is periodic so that the right-hand side is time independent. So now, let's say the way of thinking is trying to find a rotating frame so as to make this fully time independent. In case you don't succeed, maybe you can make that already the time dependence reduced quite a lot, right? And if you view it that way, it's easier to extract some info. Even in the case where you did not manage to make it fully time independent, you can extract a lot of information from this procedure that can be somehow interesting. So now what I would like to do is to look at three examples or three cases where we use this strategy to obtain something hopefully meaningful. So the first case is the case where the many-body Hamiltonian that we look at is itself many-body localized in the sense that it can be described by fully many-body localized, so in the sense that it can be described by a full set of local integral of motions.
Sorry, can I ask a question? Before we move ahead, the equations you just erased, so if I don't put P there, suppose I just write UT as E minus I H effective T, then you're saying that in all Fourier system, H effective is never local.
Wait, but if you don't put the P, first of all, it's not correct, right? Because that would only be correct for T of the time K times T. But maybe this is what you have in mind.
Yeah, I want T order.
So if you look at stroboscopic times, then that would be correct, right? So you can write it.
H-effective is some Hamiltonian. Why does it depend on that?
No,
If I look at T order, capital T.
Yeah. Here we saw a problem with the factorials. Uh-huh. I'm not gonna solve this problem. I think this problem just is the reality. So that is not gonna change, at least in general, right? So what I hope to do a bit better when trying to proceed that way than just by brutal expansion is that first, in some specific case, and I wanted to speak about one of those specific cases, actually there are some cancellation that you don't see at all when writing the Magnus expansion, and that makes that this H effective would eventually be sum of local terms. And then in the case where probably there is not such a cancellation, the fact that you express the thing as a in the rotating frame, it helps to extract information. Because if you just say, okay, we have an asymptotic expansion, what does that mean? What physical what physical information can you extract from it, right? So the hope was that, and well, it's a justified hope that doing that way you can then say what are physical consequences of what you have. So that, yeah.
So just to get a view, is there a, how does this work for just like a because usually when you think of that stupid problem, you go to a rotating frame, which you can sort of guess by looking at it, but then you throw out a counter-rotating term, the age effect part.
You throw what?
You throw out some part which is higher frequency, like the classic two-level rotating wave calculation.
Yeah.
So you don't get an age effective. If you don't throw it out, you don't get a time-independent age effective, I don't think.
Right. So
is there a, like, can you fully solve that problem with this formalism and get an age effective that's time-independent and p-effective?
I hope I could. So the it's true that, you see, if you have a 2x2 matrix, you can diagonalize. Here, if it's even if Hamiltonian is 2x2, it's not that you can solve it like explicitly just by writing the formula, right? So this will not be that simple. So instead, what the way we have used it, it was always perturbative, which means that you don't have to do it. I mean, the P of T, we eventually want to construct iteratively as a first P1 of T that would get rid of all what you can in first step, and then there are still time-dependent terms left over. Then you will produce a second transformation to remove them, and then you will do basically infinitely many of them if you would like to solve your problem fully. And it is not that I see that because it would be a single spin that you would manage to avoid doing this very long procedure. I mean, maybe yes, but I don't know it. So in that respect, it's not clear to me that the single spin would become just a trivial problem.
That's actually why I was asking, because when you do the stupid thing with the single spin, the second step is I'll throw out the hard part, which is the thing going at twice the frequency.
It's because you're missing a conserved integral of motion. So in general, you can never do it. You can never. Only the paramagnetic resonance problem.
No, I must add that we only looked at problems that can be done like perturbatively, like frequency very high, right? So if you have a two-spin problem, you could say, well, there need to be a solution, even non-perturbative. But there also, I'm ignorant how to obtain this solution. So, okay. Okay. So let me. So three. I said three examples, right? So first example would be. So you have the full Hamiltonian H of T is this one, and let's take the case where H0, it's an MBL Hamiltonian itself. Okay, if it's MBL, somehow some of the complaints that I had before should a bit disappear, because, for example, when I said, well, a system should be able to absorb any frequency, well, that's not true for an MBL system, so that already fails. And also, if you think that MBL will be described by all those local integral of motions, then you may think that locally it looks like a finite system. And then since for finite system this procedure should work, you may think that it will work here again. And so this is what we tried. So this result is not a mathematical result, but let's say it's at least level of some, we find high plausibility, but okay, it depends on what your level of rigor, let's say. So we have two conditions. So assume that J over nu, so nu is 1 over T, right? That is pretty small. And assume that G square over nu times W is also pretty small. And W, what it is, it's the disorder in the quench disorder of the Liom, so the disorder strength. Then our claim is that in that case, we can find the edge effective, which is a sum of local terms. And moreover, edge effective is itself MBL. So there are two claims, actually. So not only is that what we wanted, but the thing that we find has the special structure of being FBL, and of being FBL, MBL, which is sort of consistent with the idea that if it were not, then it could have absorbed frequency, and in that case, the result would have been sort of a bit strange. So let me... perhaps first a couple of remarks before saying the intuition probably you would like to understand where that comes from, right? So a couple of remarks. So first is that those conditions does not impose, so we do not impose that J over W is small, which means that for most of the times, if J is much larger than the disorder here, for individual times, this Hamiltonian does not need to be itself MBL. So the thing that we asked was that, perhaps here something wasn't clear, so I was assuming that V of T was zero average. So, V of S, yes, from 0 to T, T0, so otherwise this decomposition was not quite well defined, right? So the time, what I call the time independent part, is the average over one period of the full Hamiltonian. So those Hamiltonians for individual times might well not be MBL, but what counts for this result is that the average is MBL. So that is the condition that we found.
So, and you don't require anything on BLT, on B of T, can it be like selling quenches like what you showed before?
Here I will do a computation in the frequency domain, but what we did was that we avoided completely the use of frequency domain in our computation. So what was important is that phi of T is bounded. So let's say phi of T remains smaller than, I don't know, some constant for all t, right? So the supremum over the time, that will be bounded, but the square signal would be okay, or even something very weird you could allow. Now, about that issue. So if you take something which is not like the square signal, but with something which would be a bit smooth, then we realize that those conditions are probably not optimal. And there is, if you, for example, want to know the transition, so if you want to know the transition when if nu gets reduced, according to that, there should be delocalization. For smooth signals, those conditions are not the best. And there is a slightly more physical way to think that there are adiabatic crossings in the system. So when you have an adiabatic crossings, what happens is that, so this is the case where you have, so this is that the diagram. So adiabatic crossings means that the evolution of the system will change state, right? So this is the case where there will be hybridization between Lyons that are far apart. And if you start taking nu to go to zero, you can make crossings with Lyons that are further and further apart of you. And if that happens, you increase the chance that you will have such an adiabatic crossing, and if that happens, this is a mechanism for delocalization. So I will not speak about that here because it would be sort of be a little bit another topic, but somehow just to say you that those conditions might not be always optimal, although in the case where the signal is a square signal, they could perhaps still be in fact. Another thing that perhaps for you is obvious, but for us was quite a mystery for a while, is that this seems like an example where a linear response is violated. So if you go to the linear response should be obtained in the limit where J is going to zero, right? So you take J going to zero and you look for times that are something like linear response should be valid for times like 1 over J or perhaps even 1 over J squared or so. And the MOT formula predicts that the AC conductivity should not vanish, in the low frequency limit. And there was some recent work, I think, by Marcus and Sarang and perhaps even other people here that just generalized this MOT formula in the many body context. And they found that this AC conductivity function of nu should be nu square. And this is not what Seder Wu result, right? Because if you take J to zero, eventually, whatever nu you take, those conditions are going to be satisfied. And in that case, we predict localization, which is seems inconsistent with this one.
I guess I don't see that they're inconsistent, right? I mean, you sort of transiently heat up, and then you saturate to some like still localized.
Right, exactly. So I mean, you're absolutely right. But for us, it was very difficult to imagine that happened. It took us a while before that we thought about that, right? So indeed, it's really out of equilibrium, right? So this conductivity is computed with respect to the Gibbs measure, and indeed it heats up, so it moves to a non-equilibrium state, and when it is there, then localization just show up. So this result refers to much longer time than the time that you would see in the linear response regime, right? Okay, so
this time, sorry. So I missed the beginning, so maybe you might have mentioned this, but so there's you know, linear response refers to the initial transient growth, and if the system is not isolated, that transient is somehow the steady state as long as the heat is channeled away. If the system is isolated, regardless of whether it's localized or delocalized, you will eventually change the distribution to flow to infinite temperature, unless you have localization, you're saying. So is there a statement of the connection, or rather disconnection, between the transient behavior captured by the linear response and the flow k steady state that you're, I believe, addressing, that they're somehow connected by a time scale that finite or infinite in system size, or?
No, I think the time scale, I mean, I would guess that the linear response would be valid now. I don't know if it's 1 over j or 1 over j square, where j is this coupling parameter. So for those times, I think the linear response should apply. And then it changes. But you could say, okay, if the system was ergodic, what will, during the linear response time, the system just moved to another equilibrium state that would again be described by the Gibbs ensemble, so that the linear response would keep being valid for longer times. But apparently, if the system was MBL, then it's not the case, at least if...
Time local linear response.
Time? Right.
The way you define linear response is that as the time goes, the system is thermalizing, but thermalizing to a new temperature, and so you recompute the response to that temperature.
Right. That would...
Well, the reason I'm asking, because some of this sort of localization at late times, is it just a manifestation of essentially hole burning, which is also a linear response statement that you've superheated some degrees of freedom to infinite temperature?
What is hole burning? I just did not understand.
No. The question is that when you find localization, is it a statement in the flow case? Right. So it's hard for me to see what happens in the flow case, sort of a steady state. But if you just take a two-level system or five-level system, I don't know, and you drive it at one frequency, if there's a near resonance near that frequency, you will just saturate that transition. So there's a 50-50 sort of a type of Rabi oscillation, and that state no longer absorbs power.
Right, so
that's Holberg. That's what
I see.
That's the undergraduate physics sort of level discussion of Holberg.
Right.
So the question is that is your flow k local main body localized state is essentially a statement that at that frequency you found all the resonances, you saturated them, and the thing became sort of a...
Yeah, you could say that, I think, in the sense that there are indeed some... There are, I mean, most of them just don't resonate at all with the driving, right? So just nothing happens. But there are some spots where you will indeed have some, and they will heat up. Mm-hmm. But, okay, then I will not go very much in those details, but you should indeed have to prove that those will not invade the rest of the system.
Right? No, I understand that's a challenge. But basically, in some sense, you have gone to infinite temperatures someplace.
Yeah, in some places where there is, because there could be some ergodic spot or so, or spots that are really somehow match the frequency of the driving, so that another thing happens, right?
Thank you.
Yes.
Can I ask one more question?
Yes.
Quickly, just if I increase G so that these conditions are violated in any way, either of those, does the system become, do you expect that where dynamics becomes non-MBL is the same point where H effective becomes non-local?
I tend to think that there is quite a connection, yes, in the sense that I have in mind that it's sort of Okay, we are saying if it's MBL, then it will also be local, but I tend to think that there is sort of the opposite connection could be true as well, right? So that if it's local, then it's also needs to be sort of, there need to be something very special so that it's sort of incompatible that H would be ergodic and still some of local terms. But I cannot really argue for this claim, but I have the feeling that might be right, yes. Okay, so let's do one step of this, right, to see a bit how things do look like in practice. So let's try to take P of T. Well, let me think of nu to be really this large parameter of the problem, and let me anticipate the condition that I set. So let's take P of T as E minus G over nu times A of T, where A of T would be an antisymmetric matrix. Which means that this is a rotation matrix, right? So then what you do is very sort of brutal expansion, right? So you write E minus G over nu A of T, and you sandwich between A0 plus J V of T minus I D dt. Here you have plus. And you can write a full series for that, and that's going to converge. So let me just write the first terms, because otherwise it's a bit tricky to do. So first you have those terms, then you have minus I J over nu dA dt. Then start coming some commutator, so you will have J over nu, let's say, I thought here, with the convention, this should be plus and minus. Let's say A, T, A0, and then come terms that are O of J square over nu. Okay, and the goal is to do the following, that you try to find A so that this big part just will be canceled. So that means that you will have reduced the time-dependent part of the Hamiltonian, which now is a rest term of order J square over nu here. So you can do this computation. I mean, this cannot be solved. In fact, if you assume that your H0 is given in a Lyon basis, right? So what it would be in the Lyon basis, it would be, so let me spare you this computation. So then you have essentially V. So those are the Fourier component of the time dependence, right? So it's a bit more, it's not the good way to do it in the Fourier basis, but it's more easy to see at the end what the things mean. So here you have the energy difference between eta and eta prime divided by nu, and then you have 2pk here. And an important condition is that k will not be zero. Why not be zero? Because I asked here that it was a zero integral thing, so there will be, delta e can sometimes be zero because it's not eta. So eta and eta prime are just states that label all the Lyons in the system, right? So the diagonal terms do show up in this formula, but k will never vanish. And you see that what it means that it is many-body localized, it means that...
What is Lyon?
What is Lyon?
Yeah, what word are you saying?
Sorry. So perhaps I should say Lyon, I don't know. People for systems that are fully localized, people built up the picture that it can be written as a sum of quasi-local, or let's say pseudo-spin operators that are mutually commuting. So let's say that H...
It's just the acronym that's confusing us, okay?
So. You know it then?
What is the acronym? Write it on the board.
The word.
It's a local integral of motion.
Oh, huh.
Okay, yes. So I don't need to no.
Leon, not a very common name.
So, but so we may, I think, or at least the way I think of it, as basically uncoupled spins, just like spin, just the basis of spin up and down, essentially. So somehow something like that, right? So, I mean, so if it's, this is a local operator, the V, or it, rather it's a sum of local operators. And each local component, because the system is localized, is itself local in this basis, meaning that it's quite unlikely that you will manage to make this energy difference here to be exactly of the order of k, and that is the reason why those things are, I mean, why this matrix is indeed well-defined of order one. Now, if you would like to go slightly further, there are places, maybe not in this order, because you could say, well, here, this will just be of order one, and if nu is really large, that's just impossible that you compensate for that. But if you proceed iterating, will come a time where you can manage to create energy difference which will be of order nu, and then it's not a priori excluded that you don't go to there, but still, because of disorder, still could be quite rare. You could, so there could be some spots, and you could still ask what to do if you see a resonant spot. So this would still be possible with this method. Let me first explain where is the second condition coming from. So here you have a rest term of order j squared over nu, and you see that for the perturbation I asked that it was zero mean. So a priori, due to the commutators, this term will not be zero mean. So I will have to renormalize the time-independent Hamiltonian. And if I want to be able to make next step, I must make sure that this will again be an NBL Hamiltonian. Hence, this perturbation must be smaller compared to the disorder. And that is the origin of the J square over nu divided by W smaller than 1. So let me just very brief, I don't know what time it is, in fact. All right, it should be OK. Briefly mention, so in case you have some spots, so let's say here there is a spot, and here there is a spot in this one-dimensional system. Well, then what you can always do is to come back to this. I mean, you know that this a priori should exist, and you limit your Hilbert space to the space limited on those spots, and you just say, well, I know by abstract nonsense that there must be the P of T in this part, right? And though it's abstract and not constructed via perturbation, it's OK in the sense that this acts clearly locally, right? So here, there the reason why the transformation P was preserving locality is because we see it explicitly from perturbative computation. Here, the reason why it is preserving locality is because we restricted ourselves to disconnected sets, right? So the fact that it follow very closely, if you look at Imbri's work for the usual MBL, I mean, this follow very closely the same lines, what we were sort of happy about it. Well, perhaps if you think that there are mistakes in Imbri, it's not good that we follow it closely, but I think that I'm convinced that this work is quite correct, in essentially, at least. So now let me take two other examples. So we would like to say also something about the cases where there is not really an effective conserved quantity, but perhaps something that will stay for a long time. So which means that now let's take a system which is ergodic, or expected to be ergodic at least. So ergodic. So it's still the same system. And we could still apply those. So the previous result was not mathematical result, but here we made it up to something that is really that we really can show sort of rigorously. So it's also a bit an easier result, in fact. So we wanted to construct the best sort of best approximation for this effective Hamiltonian up to very long time. And let me quote the result. So one is that there is indeed, so So let me change name, right? I will not call it HF anymore. I will call H star to say that it is not the true effective Hamiltonian, but the effective Hamiltonian, if you show something for finite time. So you will have, so you evolve H star minus H star, and this remains bounded by, so it grows linearly in time, but there is a huge factor here. And I wrote the result for stroboscopic. So here I wrote the result for times that are a multiple of the period, but you could, if you allow for small errors, you can generalize to other times, but I think it's easier like that. So you see that still the error grows like the volume of the system, so lambda is volume. But then it means that up to time of order E over C nu, like exponential in the frequency, this H star that we can find is sort of approximately conserved quantity of the system, right? And so this, I think if you would do carefully the Magnus expansion, you could recover this result. It was quite not easy to see how to bound those terms, but it probably would succeed. We have also a result about local observable. So let's say O local observable. And then, so what it says is that if you evolve a local observable with the true Hamiltonian, or if you evolve it with this effective Hamiltonian, well, for a long time, that will actually create almost no difference. So minus and that, let me say precisely the bound. So we have C and okay, here in the time, so here it was growing linearly with time. Here we obtain in the exponent something with grow with dimension. I don't know whether that is correct. It changes very little, right? But so we had to use Lee-Robinson bound, and it came like that. But yes.
Yeah. So in the previous equation, what is the v in the denominator? C over v.
No, it's new. Sorry.
So. Oh.
Well, it's pretty marginal compared to that, but I just like it more that way. Yes.
Here, got it. Is the assumption that the ETH is satisfied by H0 or?
No, so it's not. I mean, if you would take it MBL, it would work also.
So there's no assumptions on H0. This is for.
Oh, there are some. I mean, it's not. Bosons would not fit really. So we took a system where it was the on-site energy was bounded. I think you could also try to do bosons, but maybe you don't get exponential, or perhaps you get it, but somehow we just did not really. I mean, the overall strategy would work the same, but somehow we restricted the result to that kind of systems. But so there is no other assumption that, so it's quite generic, and it's also not, so the MBL was limited to dimension one, and I mean, this can be in high dimensional lattices here.
I think the question was, what do you mean by an ergodic?
Well,
I guess he's saying any. No, right. So I wanted to say, yeah, okay, perhaps the name was not well chosen. So
a bounded local Hilbert space is fine.
Yeah, so this is not, indeed, it's not, should not be defined as ergodic, but I meant if it wouldn't be ergodic, then this result is maybe not optimal. Okay, if it's ergodic, well, okay, I would not claim it's optimal, but let's say we couldn't do better at least, yes. So let's say in the, okay, let's not use ergodic here, let's say generic, okay? This was actually what I meant, yes. So there is no specific assumption except local bounded energy, yes, yeah.
I might have missed this also. What is H star again here?
It's the H star is, indeed I did not define it, so let's say that we will apply the procedure that I was describing a couple of times, okay. And we will find an effective Hamiltonian, which,
right,
however, is not the full effective Hamiltonian, because we know that might be perhaps very badly behaving, but it will be a finite order approximation of this one. So that's why I just used different notation to distinguish those two objects.
I'm a little surprised that you think it can work for bosons, because naively, if I have an infinitely huge Hilbert space on site, there's nothing stopping me from, you know, absorbing huge amounts of frequency at short times. Yeah.
It might take
even a short time, you say?
Yeah, because I mean, if your Hilbert space is huge, like, you know, there's nothing bounding the size of the term that's like b dagger to the 25, b to the 25, right? I mean, that term's not.
No, you're right. But you see, then I think here we use operator norms for those.
Yeah.
I think you would like to trace over in equilibrium. Then you use the fact that having 10,000 bosons in one side is sort of unlikely event, and so indeed this would not be operator norm.
Yeah.
Also because it would make no sense, right? The Hamiltonian itself is unbounded, so that it just has no meaning at all. But
so you have to redefine things in a way that...
I do think so. As I said, we didn't do it, but I think if you take account that having piling up 1,000 bosons is something that would be uncommon at the temperature that you look at, I think that you could recover results that are similar in spirit to those ones. Right.
So I should think of... Got a feeling. So I should think of that object which you're sort of norming. Is that basically an error?
Right. So it means
errors that you make by this.
Okay, you time evolve H star with the true dynamics.
True dynamics. Yeah.
And somehow it for a long time you don't see difference with that almost. So it stays like it's almost conserved quantity for a long time. So the way to approach this is exactly like this one. There is just one small difference. So you just take...
I'm just still long. I'm generally uncomfortable with H star because the evolution operator, you know, you're taking in some sense logarithm of the evolution operator. So if I look instead at the true evolution operator versus the one that you compute here and take a difference of that? Is this... Should I naively interpret this result as that you exponentially diverge from the true evolution operator in time? It's the same.
Second level.
I'm sorry. Yes, thank you. Well, except there's an O in there.
So the
sub. It's related. Yeah.
It's okay or not?
Mm-hmm.
The H star and the H effect, the true H effective, they are quite different, I think. Totally different, in fact. But this is much more interesting to have this than the H effective.
Okay. And H star is supposed to be local.
What?
H star is supposed to be local.
Yeah. Right. So that's otherwise it would not be. So this is supposed to be some of quasi-local terms, right? So I mean, obviously they start being commutators, but yeah, it's so this is the interest of it, right?
That's key.
Right.
Otherwise, it would be uninteresting, I would say. Okay. So, how do you proceed to you can apply the same strategy. So the only difference that shows up is the following, that you say if now H0 is possibly ergodic, maybe this will be a problem because here we will have a difference of energy that can exactly come close to K, and that will not work. So what do we do? Instead of trying to get rid of all the terms here, we decide to get rid only of those terms here, those two first terms. And That's good because you see you have still 1 over nu here, and 1 over nu is pretty small, so that means that you are still reducing your perturbation by a factor 1 over nu. And this you can compute quite explicitly, so what means, what will be the A here? So you will have A of T is, so you have just to solve this, and this is sort of simple, so integral from 0 to t, and one assume that it is mean 0, so that's okay. And again, you will have to renormalize a bit the Hamiltonian. So the price to pay is, well, you could ask now, why didn't you do that already in the first problem, right? Because if it works, it works. So you see here the convergence will be rather different. So after n step, you will have a perturbation which will be 1 over mu to the power n, while with the if you had also incorporated this, you had a convergence which is quadratic and which goes much, much better. And it's presumably the reason why this procedure here cannot be iterated ad infinitum, so we have to stop at some point. Okay. Let me not enter too much in that. So let me just say that so eventually from this picture one is able then to you have to do an optimization procedure, see when you have to stop, but that I explained more or less. It's like n equal 1 over t, and one can get then those bounds from there. So maybe a last application of the formula that we have not really yet worked out, but I think do fit into this. So let me be a bit sketchy because we did not really work it out fully, but let's say let's consider a system where you would have two quantities that are close to conserved, and we could say, let's say the Hubbard model.
So in that setting then, is H star going to be equal to H zero? Because if you keep sending the terms to zero and you keep pushing away the difference to higher and higher or one over mu, aren't you saying that H star is basically
zero? In first order, yes.
So higher orders, so the second order, you're going to get a correction. Which is
You are going to get a correction because the this one might still be mean zero because you need the time average you need to put into the H zero, so or in the H star, let's say. So this is in time independent, so this still averages to zero, produce nothing, but this term will again produce something, right? Because you have commutators of things, you have product of things that depend on time, so the average will not generally be zero. So you will the next correction will be j square over nu. Yeah. So you will there will be a lot of renormalization of this initial Hamiltonian. So let's say this would be this, and let's say it would be the case where you have strong repulsion. So. And then you have a coupling and something like that, right? Or let's say there's no need to be 1D or so. So, and then you have the hopping, and I would look at the case where T is much smaller than usually it's not called nu, but since for us nu was the large parameter, I keep using that, right? So. I read that perhaps in 1D this model is integrable or so, but I don't want to consider any integrable model here. So they can't be integrable, it's allowed, but let's take it so that this it's not supposed to be an ingredient, right? So what you would observe that you would have some places with singlets, so just a single particle per side, and place where you have doublets, and that is singlets, or just sides that are empty. And because of this term, to destroy a doublet costs a lot of energy, or to create a doublet costs a lot of energy. So you would like to say, well, the number of singlets and number of doublets are approximately conserved quantity of the system, and one would like to see that. So let me rewrite Hamiltonian. So you would have Hamiltonian is nu times an energy, a diagonal energy term, which is here. And then you would have three terms. One would be a part which just connect singlets among themselves, so H of H singlets. And then you would have a part, in principle, a part that connect doublets among themselves, so H. Well, in this case, this is zero because there is nothing that you can go from a doublet directly from a doublet. But let's say. After some perturbation terms will show up. And then you will have the last term, which is the one that you want to get rid of, which is the thing that destroy a singlet to create a doublet, or vice versa, right? And what I say is that this strategy, I will not rewrite it again, but this strategy can again be used to try to eliminate that term here. So this will play the role of the d, the IDDT, and this will be the thing that we'll have. So this will be the DDT here, and this will be the part that you want to get rid of, and you could do the same expansion and show that you have indeed two approximately conserved quantity that at the level of bare things correspond to number of singlets and number of doublets. So this would be, let's say, another kind of applications of the technique which is here, let's say. Okay, so that's it, more or less.
So,
thank you. Any questions?
Nice question. I was looking at time-dependent Hamiltonian, which is periodic. Time-dependent periodic Hamiltonian. Okay, kind of system. I thought, so someone, I was trying to understand, I thought there were some proofs where they say that there's still some Lee Robinson kind of bounds, even in a time-dependent systems.
Ah.
Is it correct or not? If I take correlation functions, the commutator or operator is like spacetime at various times, and they still decay e to the power minus. In a time-dependent system where the Hamiltonian is local but time-dependent.
Yeah. Right.
If that's correct, then how do I see the? But on the other hand, the H effective you get by looking at the Broca H effective is generally non-local, as you tried to argue.
Yes.
So,
are you saying you find that contradictory?
Yeah, they seem a bit not necessarily, but they a bit contradictory. I would think if it's something very non-local, then it will not have Lee Robinson code.
Yeah,
on the other hand, so what's going on?
It's not that non-local. So what eventually is non-local is this specific Hamiltonian. For example, even in an ergodic system, you could say the eigenstate are totally non-local objects, which is not contradicting that Lee Robinson. There is a local structure in the system, definitely. We start with this Hamiltonian. So first of all,
How non-local is it? If I take a generic time-dependent Hamiltonian?
I was thinking that it was decaying very fast, right? Like exponential or even just... The thing that I was started with, right? So now, whether those results would extend to things that decay a bit slower, you have to think, right? I did not know that Lee Robinson was valid for those systems, but it sounds very plausible. Yes.
Yeah. There must be some conditions, right? I have never heard of Floquet Lee Robinson.
I think it probably holds. I guess the issue is just sort of, what you're asking is like, if the unit tree is obeying the Lee-Robinson bounds, like, and the H effective is not, like, how do those things fit together, right? I think that this is some cancellation that, because the Hamiltonian is like log of the unit tree,
right.
And that just doesn't have a well-defined Taylor expansion, so have some weird stuff that happens.
Yeah, Hamiltonian is just a word
here. Yeah. Right.
Another way to say it is that if it's local, then you can argue the unit tree generates a local, but not the other way around. It's not a familiar.
Mm.
Given a local unit tree, it's not clear just randomly as evenly IH produces a local.
That's all going on, yeah.
So the statements are that under some reasonable conditions, the Floquet unitary can still give you Lee Robinson type.
I think it has to.
Yeah, it has to.
Even in the ergodic phase?
Yeah.
It's morally disputable.
Okay.
I like looking more out on these arguments. The only other thing is that you can take any local Hamiltonian and rewrite it as a sum of projectors on eigenstates, and it's a non-local Hamiltonian, but it'll still have the in it.
That's a different thing.
It's just decomposition. Anyway, okay. Sorry, are there other questions? Before we degenerate.
I have one more question. No one has it. imply? Well, so if I give you a U, which is U of capital T, which describes a time evolution over time T, is it known how to write down so log of U again will be some weird object, some non-local object, but is it known how to express that as e to the power, how to express that as a time evolution by a time-independent local Hamiltonian? So e to the power minus h time-dependent dt. Time order. Is it always possible to do that?
I mean, that is what it is. That's what the unitary is, right? If you put the time ordering in, like, it's just sort of, you're just time evolving, but it's time-dependent Hamiltonian, it has this periodic thing.
No, I'm posing the condition that this time-dependent Hamiltonian be fully local.
The time-dependent Hamiltonian is fully local. The generated dynamics is a Hamiltonian.
But I'm saying, how do you find that? I'm only giving you.
Oh, I see.
The question is, given a unitary U, I'm not giving you any other information. Is it known how to find a time-dependent Hamiltonian, which is continuous time now, it's not discrete time, which generates a scene dynamics?
Dependent, no, independent.
Time-dependent.
Time-independent is probably too hard, probably never happens. Yeah. But I'm allowing you to be use time-dependent as a way to generate locality.
And this would be local, you want that?
Yeah, I'm asking, yeah. Is it known, is there a procedure based on your, you have some experience with all these things.
No, I have no idea what the answer is.
What about short times?
Arbitrary times.
I think in a short time expansion, I can imagine reconstructing the evolution. But for I'm not even sure what is.
If the Hamiltonian expands,
all you have is a time ordered protocol for constructing the unitary. So
come on, I'm just saying that in the Flocke case, you started from a very local, fully local Hamiltonian, and you got some H effective which was non-local.
Yes.
So clearly that's an infinite class of problems where people have already done it. But I'm asking the reverse question.
So in the usual sort of a textbook sense, if you have a time dependent Hamiltonian, the only way you can discuss the unitary via this time ordering sort of expansion.
Right.
Doesn't that seem like it's a meaning to one mapping?
Yeah.
It's clearly infinite. Maybe they're infinite. Yes. Yeah. I'm saying, is there one? I'm just finding one of them. I want to find just one of them. I don't care how you get me the answer.
I would start in the short time expansion.
Do you want the Hamiltonian to be smooth in time?
Yeah.
I think there's a meaning to once you're okay. I don't know.
But if you have the unitary at all times, you also have the unitary at short times.
But I think that generally gives you something which is similar to H effective, which is not local.
No,
short times. I mean, think of the charter, right? I mean, you want to do it from time one to one plus epsilon. Fine, start there. And that's your short time.
But I think the counter example is just a single spin. So if you have a single spin in a random in a magnetic field that where there's no conserved quantity, so it's not just around one axis, you're not just in a rotating frame, there's no way, that's not an integrable problem. So there's no way to compose those products in a way that you get this the result you want, which is you want to just write it as e to the I some evolving matrix, right? Because then you could just always solve it. But I think it's impossible.
Yeah. In some cases, maybe it's not possible.
I don't know if there's.
Okay, well, thanks.